Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to one of the most momentous strikes of the second half of the 20th century. It came in August 1981 when the professional air traffic controllers decided to strike. It was a strike that reflected the progressive idealism and hopes of the 60s that would run headlong into Ronald Reagan's conservative revolution of the 1980s. These two forces, which had been on a collision course since JFK signed an executive order allowing government workers to organize unions, had their ultimate collision on August 3, 1981. Since that time, like the Big Bang itself, the pieces thrown off from that collision have shaped our politics right up until today. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Joseph McCartin. He's an associate professor of history at Georgetown University, and it is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about his new book, Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. Joseph McCartin, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be with you, Jeff.
It is really remarkable that in this event, in this strike, we really had forces coming together, as you write about, that really had been growing since the 60s. You sort of begin the process with this air crash that happened in the early 1960s, but really it reflected political change that had been happening as well.
That's right, Jeff. As you mentioned in your introduction, two forces came barreling out of the 1960s, you might say, that were on a collision course with each other. One was the movement of public sector workers to organize unions, which really transformed American labor relations over the course of the 1960s. That was a movement strongly linked to and influenced by the civil rights movement. And as African Americans began campaigning for their full rights as citizens, many government workers began to wonder why they didn't have many of the rights that private sector workers had, including the right to organize, bargain collectively, and even in some cases, strike. And in the 60s, public sector workers began to organize in many settings, teachers, firefighters, sanitation workers, and also air traffic controllers. So that was one thing that happened in the 60s. And the second was that in reaction to much of the upheaval of the 60s, the conservative movement that produced Ronald Reagan as its candidate for president in 1980 also came out of the 60s energized and determined to roll back many of the changes that the 60s had initiated. And indeed, in August 1981, public sector unions and Ronald Reagan had a collision that continues to shape American industrial relations and politics 30 years later.
And if that wasn't enough in terms of the forces that were coming together here, you also talk about what went on during the Carter years, during the 70s, which was also a precursor to this, and that we had the beginnings of globalization. We had the deregulation of the airline industry and even the impact of Vietnam and soldiers that would return from Vietnam.
That's absolutely right. And all of those things played a role in bringing about the confrontation that ultimately happened in 1981. Air traffic controllers, like other government workers and like other federal workers in the 1970s, found themselves in a bind. While John F. Kennedy allowed them to organize unions beginning in 1962, as you mentioned earlier, the federal law did not allow workers to bargain over things like their salaries. And in the 1970s, as globalization and the energy crisis and other things struck our economy, workers found themselves beset by inflation, which was really decreasing their wages over time, and air traffic controllers became restive over that. That was one part of what pushed them into a confrontation by 1981. Another part was that these were men and women who were products of the Vietnam era. More than 80% of controllers had been in the military at one point, and those who struck in 1981 were a majority of them of the Vietnam era military. And they entered government employment already having been burned, you might say, by the Vietnam experience, many of them being disillusioned by that, and they felt that the government wasn't treating them fairly. Those things helped to create this mammoth confrontation.
go back and talk about the crash that happened off of Brooklyn in 1960 and the way that that really begun the chain of events that we're talking about.
That's right. I opened the book talking about this horrific event. It happened on December 16th, 1960. Two airliners collided over New York Harbor. One of them was shattered immediately. The other was badly damaged, fatally damaged, and ended up flying a few more miles and then crashing into the streets of Brooklyn. All in all, 134 lives were lost in that horrific event. And the air traffic controllers who were working in the New York area on that morning were shaken and scarred by that that terrible tragedy. They had been warning their supervisors and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, leaders that they were working with faulty equipment. Some of the equipment in use in 1960 was war surplus equipment that had been taken off of battleships. Old radar scopes that had once been used to track submarines were being used to track airplanes in 1960. And the controllers felt overwhelmed by the rapid growth of air traffic. That event really galvanized them and led them to think that if they didn't organize themselves and try to pressure the FAA to improve the system, there would be more disasters like this. Two particular controllers, one named Jack Maher, another named Mike Rock, were working that morning. Neither were directly involved in this collision. And by the way, air traffic controllers weren't found to blame in this event. But those two guys were so affected by this that they teamed up and started to try to organize. It took a number of years, but by 1968, the fruit of their efforts was this group called PATCO, the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization. So it initially started as an effort to try to reform the FAA and make air traffic, air travel safer.
One of the things that allowed them to begin to form PATCO after this was this executive order that Kennedy had signed, Executive Order 10988, that allowed the organizing of government workers, but did it in a way that sort of tied one hand behind their back.
That's exactly right, and that's part of what I think led to this tragedy ultimately, is that from the very beginning, the government got off on a bad foot regarding how to work with its employees. Kennedy's order empowered workers to organize unions, but it gave their agencies tremendous resources to resist that organization and not to have to recognize controllers' organizations as controllers were trying to form them. It also, as I mentioned earlier, didn't allow federal workers to bargain over some of the things that they felt were most important to them, including their wages, the length of their work week, but also such items as the kinds of technology that they were using. So the order gave the appearance of empowering workers to organize, but the reality that Maher, Rock, and other controllers faced was that they couldn't make much headway under this order. And they discovered very quickly that the only way to get the government to act on their concerns was to bring pressure to bear, to engage in various kinds of job actions to try to make the FAA listen to them. And part of my argument is that had the system been set up better from the beginning, the pattern of conflict that emerged between the FAA and PATCO might never have come about.
And yet one of the ironies of this is that PATCO supported Reagan when he was running for the presidency in 1980, was one of the few labor unions to do so.
That's exactly right, and that has to do with something you mentioned earlier, the Jimmy Carter administration. When Jimmy Carter was elected in 1976, air traffic controllers believed that perhaps a savior was taking office who would hear their concerns and who would respond to them. He was the first Democrat elected since PATCO had been formed. He was endorsed by PATCO in 1976. But over the course of the Carter administration, they became so deeply disillusioned with Carter that they never even seriously considered endorsing his reelection. What they found from the Carter administration was that they were very unwilling to negotiate over many of the issues that controllers were most concerned about, that Carter seemed most intent on balancing the federal budget and responding to the demands of conservatives in that respect, and they lost faith in him. Ronald Reagan, at the same time, a very shrewd political operator, saw an opening. Reagan's Republican Party in 1980 wanted to bring a couple of unions into its fold to basically demonstrate to the people who would be called Reagan Democrats that they could look to Ronald Reagan as an exponent of their viewpoint. Most PATCO controllers were Democrats, the majority were, but they decided to endorse Reagan after a negotiation between their union and the Reagan campaign, in which they felt that the Reagan campaign had promised to do something about their concerns if Reagan was elected. So, yes, indeed, it was ironic. They ended up endorsing the man who ultimately broke their union.
And in fact, they thought that it would be a good thing to have in the Oval Office the only president that had ever run a union.
That's right. And today, 30 years later, I think, partly as a result of the PATCO strike, most people's impressions of Ronald Reagan are that he was anti-union. In some respects, that's true. For example, in the way he dealt with Cesar Chavez's farm workers union in California. But as you say, Reagan was the only man ever to occupy the Oval Office who had once been a union leader. He led the Screen Actors Guild after World War II, and ironically, he led that union in its first strike in 1952 against studios. Reagan was not afraid of the strike as a weapon of unions. In fact, he strongly advocated that at least private sector unions had to have that right. And so it came to pass that they believed that Reagan would be an advocate for them. It didn't turn out that way.
And as PATCO went into negotiations with the FAA and the Reagan administration in 1981 before the strike, the administration really, they thought, were bending over backwards to give the union what they wanted or to give them more than other people were getting.
It was a classic case of misunderstanding on each side. And on the Reagan side, there were actually people who believed that, look, we are actually offering more than any previous administration has offered to air traffic controllers. And that was true in terms of what was on the table in the 1981 negotiation. Remember that Jimmy Carter had offered almost nothing, and the Ford administration had been equally tough with PATCO. So Reagan was more forthcoming than those previous administrations had become. However, things had reached the point by 1981, after more than 10 years of escalating conflict between PATCO and the FAA, where PATCO leaders and PATCO members really wanted a big breakthrough. And that's where, ironically, the endorsement of Ronald Reagan also played a role, because when Reagan was elected with PATCO's endorsement, it fed expectations among controllers that they could get more from this administration than ultimately the administration ever intended to offer. And so, on the one side, PATCO believed that the offer was nothing near what was fair or what they expected. And on the Reagan side, they said to themselves, we don't get it why these controllers don't see that we're doing more for them than any other administration has done. And the sides could not understand each other.
Why was it that early on in the negotiations there never was an effective back channel? In fact, you talk about Jack Meyer being surprised by this when he goes to Washington in August of 81.
That's right. And when Reagan came out within hours of the strike beginning, at 11 a.m. on the morning of the strike, August 3rd, 1981, he came into the Rose Garden and made a very public announcement, televised live. that said that if the controllers didn't return to work in 48 hours, they would be fired. Now, most controllers who heard that thought that this was an ultimatum that, of course, a president would have to give. But they believed that there would be behind-the-scenes negotiations that would take place, even perhaps after this deadline passed, that would ultimately lead to a settlement. Now, one thing, Jeff, that led them to believe that was their experience with Richard Nixon. This is something most people who remember the PATCO strike probably don't know. That is, in 1970, about 3,000 air traffic controllers participated in an illegal job action. It was basically a strike, though they called it a sick out. The FAA tried to fire several hundred leaders of that job action, and technically it had a right to do so because it was an illegal job action, just as the 81 walkout was. However, it turned out that the Nixon administration did engage in back-channel negotiations that resulted in the end with everybody getting their jobs back. And so in 1981, PATCO leaders looked back to that Nixon experience and they figured the same thing would happen again, that just as Nixon's people at least had publicly threatened to fire and permanently replace strike leaders, the Reagan people would make that threat. But in the end, the union leaders felt there was no way that the Reagan administration could operate air traffic with 75% of the controllers fired. So they really believed that there would be some back-channel settlement. It never happened, though, under Reagan.
At what point did Mike Rock, who was running the union, running the strike at that point, at what point did he and his fellow members of PATCO realize that this really was coming down to the wire, that Reagan wasn't just posturing?
Mike was a founder of the union, but by 1981 he was more of a figurehead in the leadership than the actual leader. But he still was, the union was actually led by a president named Bob Poli. But Mike was still a sort of recognized as PATCO's father, so to speak. And Mike, over the course of the 48 hours the first 48 hours of the strike, Mike began to have his doubts about whether the Reagan people would ever negotiate. And as the deadline passed, he was pretty gloomy about the prospects. Others in the leadership of the union felt, no, we're still going to be able to pull this out. But some of the union's longtime hands already were believing that, you know what, once a president lays down an ultimatum, you can't really back him off it. And that was Mike's position. So Mike worried almost immediately that the union might have boxed itself into a corner.
And what was going on simultaneously inside the White House? What was Reagan and the administration thinking about this?
Well, as it became clear, and just before August 3rd, that PATCO would not accept the offer that the administration placed on the table, everything about the Reagan White House started to focus on how to ensure that Ronald Reagan would look strong in the face of the challenge of a nationwide strike by air traffic controllers. So almost every decision was made through that lens. For example, it was debated within the administration whether the president should issue a statement before the walkout explaining that if people did walk out and they didn't return to work, that they would be fired. However, it was decided by Reagan and his advisors that that would not make sense, because if the walkout happened after the president made that announcement, it would make him look weak. So in retrospect, it could be said that Reagan, by not making clear his intentions before the walkout, probably contributed to the numbers of people who actually did walk out, and then once they had walked out, felt that they ought to stay out in solidarity with other controllers. The Reagan people were determined that the president looked strong. A second way in which this concern played out was that once the deadline passed, the majority opinion of Reagan's close advisors was that the president could never waver, that even though after 2 months or so public opinion began to shift, it initially supported the firing, but then it began to ask for moderation from the president, that he ought to rehire many strikers. The majority of advisors to the president felt, no, you can't waver, Mr. President. You have to show that when you speak and you make a deadline, you mean it, and there will be no backtracking. There will be no mercy shown to the controllers after the fact, and that was the view that prevailed.
And this really became a defining moment for the Reagan administration, for its politics, not only domestically, but internationally.
Absolutely. And one of the concerns that was in the minds of Reagan's supporters as they urged him after the fact to hold tough was how this would be seen by foreign governments, and specifically by the Soviet government, by Soviet leaders. And it turned out after the fact that Soviet leaders had, in fact, been watching this closely. And to their minds, it seemed unduly rash and risky to do what Reagan had done, to fire, in effect, three-quarters of the workforce of the people who ensured safe air travel in the country, to risk that an air disaster might happen as a result of that firing, to refuse to rehire anybody, even after it was clear he had won the battle, and to, in fact, spend far more to break the strike than it would have cost to negotiate with the controllers. The Soviets looked at all of that and got the message that Reagan had intended to send. That is, that this guy is tough. He is willing to pay any price to uphold the threats he makes, and therefore, don't mess with him. And that was a message that the Reagan people were determined to send.
Why wasn't there more public support for PATCO early on? What mistakes did they make in that regard?
Well, PATCO made a lot of mistakes in that regard. One is that they never engaged in much of a public education campaign about what it was they were after. Most people latched on to one demand that the controllers had included in their bargaining posture, and that was that they had asked for a $10,000 across-the-board salary increase, which was quite large. The average controller in 1981 earned about $31,000. It was above the median income. That is, controllers earned above the median income to begin with. They were asking for an enormous raise. Now, from PATCO's point of view, they never expected they would actually get that. They wanted to send a signal to the government, we want something significant, not nibbling around the edges. But to public opinion, they looked at that demand, and many people thought, this union's crazy. Why should we support that? This is paid for by our tax dollars. And then you add to that the fact that already in the summer of 1981, we were sliding into a recession. It came to be known as the Reagan recession because unemployment hit 10% by 1982 in that recession. And people were, concerned about their own financial well-being and looking at the controllers and characterizing them as greedy. And PATCO never really had a strategy to try to prevent that perception from forming. Instead, they sort of relied on the fact that they believed that they could take 75% to 80% of the air traffic controllers off the job. It didn't matter what the public thought. It didn't matter what the president said, that they would be able to force the government to deal with them. And in the end, they found out that public opinion does matter, and in this case, it didn't uphold them.
You talk about how public opinion started to shift after a while. What happened?
Well, as it became clear that Reagan had defeated PATCO, the public began to worry about the state of air traffic. At the very beginning, the FAA cut back the number of flights that were allowed by as much as 50%. This had an enormous impact on all of the parts of the economy connected to air travel. It was having a depressing effect on the economy in general. Then you had the question of safety. Could the system be safely run with replacement workers? Would it take too long to get this system back up and working again? And once it became clear that Reagan had won, public opinion began to shift toward a moderate position, basically saying, look, it's cheaper and for the country, it's better for air safety if we now show mercy. And it wasn't just the public at large, but even some leading Republicans took this point of view, people like Jack Kemp, the congressman from upstate New York, who later was a Republican vice presidential nominee, urged Reagan to be moderate, but the administration would not moderate.
Talk about the long-term impact to the air traffic control system from this strike.
There was an enormous long-term impact on the air traffic control system. Some people say that it took 6 to 8 years for the system to be back up to pre-strike levels. Controllers had to be rushed through the training program in Oklahoma City at the FAA facility there. And the way air traffic control works is that you can only learn so much about the job in a classroom setting or working in mock-up situations, that most of the job is on-the-job learning with a senior controller seated right by you, watching your every move. You first watch the senior controller, and then he watches you, and he instructs you. And it's a lot of intensive one-on-one training to build up a force of highly skilled professionals to do that work took years. And so the system never rebounded as quickly as the Reagan people thought it would. And then there were the impacts that spread far beyond air travel to affect other parts of the economy.
Then, of course, there's the long-term effect that is still part of our political discourse today in terms of what really is the role of public employee unions.
I think that's right. I think, unfortunately, in some ways, the Reagan handling of PATCO set a pattern that affected public sector labor relations, broadly speaking. For one thing, strikes in the public sector had grown increasingly common over the course of the 1970s. After 1981 and Reagan's breaking of PATCO, however, public sector workers of all sorts became more reluctant to strike and, in fact, to risk the kind of public rejection that happened in the PATCO strike. And this tended to push public sector unions increasingly into political activism as a way of advancing the interests of their members and away from job actions. That, I think, has had a long-term impact, which relates to another aspect of the PATCO strike. As I mentioned, Reagan in 1980 sought the endorsement of a public sector union, PATCO. That around Reagan in the Republican Party at the time of the PATCO strike, there were many moderates, people like Jack Kemp, who had close relations with the labor movement. But Reagan's handling of the PATCO strike had a deep impact, I think, on the post-1981 Republican Party. After PATCO, it became more acceptable and, in fact, more advantageous for anyone who called themselves a conservative to stake out a more strongly anti-union position. The Republican Party over time has become more and more estranged from the labor movement to the point where it's difficult to remember that Reagan wasn't as anti-union as some people who call themselves Reaganites today. And if you combine the growing estrangement of the Republican Party from labor with this growing involvement of public sector unions in the political process, it helps explain where we're at today in 2011, where Republicans around the country widely view themselves as opponents of public sector unions and have been, in some cases, waging attacks on public sector rights across the country, Wisconsin, Ohio, and right. Other states.
Were you surprised, as you got into the research on this project, how many of these contemporary political strains, everything from the union issue you're talking about to globalization that we touched on earlier to deregulation, how many of these strains run through this story?
All of them, really. And in fact, this story is really a story about how we got to where we are currently, I think, in this country. And I call the book Collision Course for a number of reasons. As you alluded to, you know, it was an air traffic collision in 1960 that sort of started this story. It was the collision between Reagan and public sector unions in 1981 that became the focus of the story. But I would say that the title of the book is also meant to allude to where we're at now. And I think we're on a kind of a larger collision course as a society. One of the long-term after-effects of the PATCO strike has been the dramatic weakening of the labor movement and of the ability of workers and of the middle class to pressure for a larger share of the productivity that comes from their labor. We've now been in a cycle of almost 30 years where median income in the country has been stagnating, while at the very top it's been growing rapidly. And I think a lot of that has to do with the forces that played out in the PATCO strike and with the long-term effects of that strike.
Joseph McCartin, his book is Collision Course, Ronald Reagan, the Air Traffic Controllers, and the Strike That Changed America. It's just out from Oxford University Press. Joseph, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff.